Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Thank you so much to everyone who came out to Aresia to watch me read erotic slash fiction live on stage. I had so much fun, and Aresia was just really great in general. You should definitely consider checking it out next year if you haven't already. My next convention will be Dreamation. That's February 16th through the 19th in Morristown, New Jersey. Dreamation is basically the first con that I ever went to and really, really loved. And it's still one of my favorites. If you're able to make it, I and a couple of other one-shot hosts will be there, playing games and having fun and hanging out, and maybe meeting you. Our guest today is Rachel Kahn, who you might know from her webcomic, By Crom. You've probably also seen her illustrations in a number of your favorite RPG source materials. But did you know that she also ran Dungeon World for a group of 6 to 12-year-olds at the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto this past summer? When I heard about this awesome project, I knew I had to have her on the show. I think you'll be as fascinated as I was. So how are you feeling? What are you up to today?
Today I am recovering from Canadian Thanksgiving. Ate too much food, as you do last. We were literally baking pies and eating them until midnight last night. So
that's a very hardcore Thanksgiving. That's very, very good.
Really intense about it. There's nothing in the house except pie.
My favorite part of Thanksgiving. I realized this yesterday. I'm in Ottawa.
Okay.
I realized this yesterday is that your first round of Thanksgiving dinner, everything's in its neat little piles. And then by your second or third helping, it's just a pile of mashed potatoes with gravy on top and stuff. And it's just actually, I just want to eat all of these things in a big mush.
All at the same time. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we are out of leftovers beyond pie. We just ate the same thing all weekend, but it was wonderful. But I'm getting back in the zone today and I'm doing some freelance concept art design. And
cool.
I'm probably going to go and do a little bit of shipping. And Tuesday night is my weekly game night. One of my two weekly game nights.
Oh, nice. So are you running? Are you GMing?
I am playing in my friend's homebrew Star Trek gumshoe hack.
Oh, cool. Oh, man. There are so many ways to hack Star Trek into something because there's no, playable Star Trek, actual Star Trek
game. Oh, really? Yeah.
How's Gumshoe working with it?
It's great. We're big Gumshoe fans. We play Gumshoe all the time in this group. And then my friend and I are also both in Robin Law's playtest group. So we're really familiar with Gumshoe. And so we're definitely biased.
Right.
But it's been great for Star Trek. It's been really easy to sort of compartmentalize things in terms of, your role on the ship and your background. And it's been really straightforward. The only thing we don't currently have a rule set for is space battles, which we've told the GM we really want to have a space battle. So hopefully that comes up soon, though. We're on a science ship, so it won't be.
You can push that back a little bit.
Yeah,
that sounds really fun. And it's kind of ironic because so many Star Trek games have just focused on naval space battles, which is not 100% of the point. I don't know, maybe you're gonna Frankenstein something together out of another game.
We're gonna see. I mean, he's it's my friend Chris Huth who's hacking it together, and he's done a lot of different gumshoe hacks over the course of our 6 or 7 years playing, and he is very familiar with the system and also familiar with how we play it, so he's got something good here, though I have no idea if another group would have the same experience. That's a different game for sure.
what's your other group? You play twice weekly. You're a lucky woman. So
I am very lucky. I'm super lucky because my other group is Robin Law's playtest group.
Oh, right.
Because we're in Toronto, so that we're on hiatus right now because he's doing conventions and doing Robin Law stuff. But we play most of the year, and I'm not sure actually what we have coming up. We just wrapped up an enormous drama system and campaign.
Cool. So, yeah. That sounds really fun. Well, I wanted to have you on the show to ask you about this work that you did at the Aga Khan Museum recently.
Which you posted a bunch about on your Patreon, which everyone should go and listen to, which everyone should go and read. But I wanted to ask you about this because it sounds like a super fun and cool, exciting opportunity, but also like, well, I mean, first of all, tell our listeners about the project and your involvement in it.
Sure. So the Aga Khan is a new museum in Toronto, and they reached out to me through a friend to see if I could help them out by running a summer D&D campaign camp for 9 to 12-year-olds for 1 week as a sort of a trial run and see if what their community thought of it, if it worked in the museum. And beyond just running D&D with the kids, what they wanted me to do was to set a campaign in the world of this 1,000-year-old epic poem called the Shahnameh, which is a poem about sort of the mythic and legendary and historical history of Persia. And so we sat down and we talked about what their goals were, and they were sort of like, let's just try it and see what we do. And they sort of dumped a pile of books in my lap and were like, go for it.
Wow. It must have been really intimidating. I mean, that's like an enormous and important source to start building a campaign on.
That was definitely probably the most intimidating part. The Aga Khan Museum is a museum focusing on the history of Islam and the Islamic culture and the diversity and plurality of Islam in the world today. And I don't practice Islam. I'm a white Canadian. I am definitely the sort of person that needs to reach out to experts mm-hmm. when I'm going to be setting things in a piece of Persian history that is still incredibly relevant to people across the world. So for me, one of the things that was really important was that I did my reading, I did my research, and the museum actually put me in touch with curators that I could talk to as well. And I had meetings and did tours around the gallery with a few curators. And that was really helpful because going in without that, I would have felt on the one hand like I was faking it and on the other hand like I was stepping on somebody else's property.
So. Yeah, totally. Well, it sounds like you had a lot of support there. So
they were great, yeah.
So on top of running a campaign, a lot of games in a very short space of time, like 2 sessions per day for like I don't know anyone who's ever played like that ever.
So I didn't totally understand how tiring that would be. I was lucky. So we had 16 kids, and so it was me and 3 sort of other camp counselors who came in to sort of assist me with the camp and with running the games. And so it was 4 of us GMing groups of 4 kids. But I had the most GMing experience of all of them in that none of them had ever GMed before.
Wow.
So all of us were going into this a little bit blind. I've run a lot of like one shots sort of with my friends, but I hadn't done a long campaign and I hadn't done 2 sessions a day for a week straight.
Yeah, wow.
But on the other hand, when you're working with the same people, it's different from, I imagine it's different from running like convention games or running 2 or 3 games a day, because you don't have to meet new people. You don't have to keep explaining the game. You don't have to reintroduce the scenario. You sit down and pick up the story with the same kids. And it actually really builds momentum. And we would, at the end of every day, the GMs, the 4 of us would have a half hour huddle and be like, what did your group do? How did it go? And it was so exciting, and we would get all pumped up and like thrilled about how it was all going because it was so fun.
Yeah,
it was so incredibly fun. Well, can't understate that.
Yeah, well, how because it sounds like the people you were working with had maybe more experience working with kids and doing camp type stuff and education. How do you prep folks like that to run a game when they maybe haven't even like played in a game?
I was lucky that they had all played at least once. Mm-hmm. I sort of explained in the museum that we really needed people who were at least familiar with the medium mm-hmm. of tabletop role-playing games, because that can be a big hurdle for people. At least, you know, once they're adults, they have to sort of try it to get a feel for it. So these people had all played before and were sort of interested and curious about running a game, at least. And yes, they all came with a lot of experience running camps for kids, being museum educators, you know, storytelling in public. Like a lot of oral storytelling is a big part of how museums do this sort of education. You introduce an artifact and you give people a narrative. So the storytelling aspect came very naturally to them, which was great. And one of them actually, Jason, was a seasoned improv
actor. That helps.
And that was, oh my God, he had a lot of really great stuff to add in terms of how to help the kids get into character and how to help them interact with the story and gain confidence in the game quickly. So they had a lot on their plates. They came with a lot of great skills and I, you know, stuff that filled a lot of my gaps because I don't have the same years of experience mm-hmm. in those fields. So what I did with them, we ended up doing a 3-hour sort of training session where I sat them down with some pre-generated characters and we all had a copy of the book. And for your listeners, we were running Dungeon World.
Right.
We ended up hacking it a bit, but we sort of went there first and I think it was a good call. So we each had a copy of the book and we sat down with character sheets and I ran them through one of the 4 campaigns I'd written. And definitely not the whole thing. We really only played for about an hour total of play because we kept stopping to talk about what we were doing, what I was doing as a GM, where I was getting the information, and then, you know, taking questions. So they had, you know, they all had the basics of sit at the table, roll dice, read off your character sheet, make decisions. But some of the core stuff of Dungeon World was new to them, especially the collaborative aspects mm-hmm. of Dungeon World. Because a lot of them had played Pathfinder or 5th edition
right.
D&D. So they had they were expecting a slightly more didactic experience. But it ended up, I think, actually being a really good aspect of Dungeon World to work with the kids. So once they got their heads around that, and they sort of... We sort of laid down a rule like, we're only playing for a week. We don't... Like, if we make up a rule at your table, you know, write it down in a notebook so you have it. But you don't have to, like, add it to some large... sort of directory of new rules. Like, it's okay if we're all a little bit flubbing this. These kids are 9 to 12. It's their first gaming experience. Focus on having fun
yeah.
and enabling, like, storytelling and exploration and collaboration over trying to run the game properly.
Right. Yeah. And so many, I think a lot of new players especially, they can get really, really, like, hooked on, am I doing this right? Am I allowed to do this? Is this going to ruin it for someone else? And very often that stuff just kind of sorts itself out. And you had all these sort of different groups running in the same fictional world, right? It wasn't like parallel playthroughs. So what would happen at one table could affect another table?
It could. We considered parallel playthroughs, and certainly that would have been less prep on my part, and I could have gotten a little deeper into that one campaign. But when you're working with kids, one of the things that I'm always wary of is giving them reasons to be competitive or judgmental. And Dungeon World enforces you can only have one ranger, you can only have one fighter, you can only have one cleric in your group. So there's not the same sort of like, well, my fighter's better than your fighter mm-hmm. possible that you might have when you have, you know, a big D&D group. But if we had, you know, one of each in each group and they were all doing the same thing, then I felt pretty confident that there would reach a stage in the middle of the week where they were like, well, I'm nearly done.
Right.
We did this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to give them reasons to feel competitive. I wanted this to really focus on being as collaborative as possible. So we ended up doing 4 concurrent campaigns.
Wow.
But that was sort of, it extrapolated well from just the way we set it up, because the way we worked with the Shanima in the end, and I think I go into this in some detail on the Patreon post if people want to really dig into it, but they isolated a specific story for me. The museum sort of directed me towards Rostam's 7 Trials, which is the story of a single hero going out and rescuing a king and his army from what's called the White Demon. So there's travel, things happen along the way, and he moves through some very specific regions, goes to the mountains, fights the demon, rescues the king, and then, you know, more story continues in the Shanima. But for us, that was sort of the arc we were going to work with. And it had a very clear sort of journey within it, which I thought was great for a campaign. And it had a lot of different possible encounters. But instead of having them alongside Rostam on this trial or, you know, ahead of him or bumping into him, I had them about 2 days behind him on average.
Right, right.
So they were, you know, we would have a storytelling session in the morning where I'd sit down with the book and I'd read them, you know, this is the stage where Rostam, he's sleeping in the desert and a lion approaches him and his horse fights the lion and defends his master. And when Rostam wakes up, he's mad at his horse for taking an unnecessary risk. And so the kids would be like, oh, but there's a dead horse that has been trampled, or sorry, a dead lion that has been trampled by a horse. So when the kids are in that region, they might encounter that lion corpse. But they would be there for their own reasons. So for each group, they had a quest that would drive them along a similar path towards the lair of the White Demon, but not at the same time or for the same reasons that Rostam was going.
Did they fight the White Demon at the end?
No, Rostam definitely kills the white demon. Spoiler alert, the white demon is super dead.
Spoiler alert for this 1,000-year-old poem.
Yeah, so the kids had their own sort of boss monsters to deal with, and some of them had friends betray them, and some of them had, you know, they knew they were going to fight one specific thing, it just wasn't the white demon. Some of them had, like, oh, you have to get into somewhere. Some of them abandoned their campaigns entirely and did whatever they wanted.
Right, which players do.
And I feel like 9 to 12-year-olds you have to expect at some point.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask about that. I mean, how was running a campaign for a table of kids different than your experience running for adults?
It's a little easier to exert authority over children than it is your friends. But there's definitely... I think when you're working with your friends, especially people who are seasoned gamers, you know, they sort of understand the unwritten rules, like be quiet when the GM is talking.
Right.
Or, you know, whether it's a competitive or collaborative game, they're going to get a feel for that really quickly. They're going to bring a lot more pop culture references to the table as well. Hmm. They're going to have a lot more sort of background knowledge. With the kids, they were a lot more open to whatever was happening, but you had to really define what was happening at the beginning and get them into that mode because it was really completely new to them.
Well, yeah.
And I imagine if we run it again and we get more of these kids, they're going to be like, oh, I know exactly what we're doing. But this was the magical first exposure for an entire group of kids to D&D, as it were, or Dungeon World specifically. So that meant that we had to talk about, well, we're going to take turns and we're going to keep our dice in this bowl and stop rolling them all the time all over the table. And we're not going to throw pencils at each other. And we're going to support each other because you're all here towards the same goal. And, you know, we're going to learn how to understand, you know, whose class does what. What are your skills versus your, you know, neighbor's skills at the table? And how do you best use those in battle, in mysteries, when you're exploring or dealing with traps? Mm-hmm. But you had to sort of lay that out for them in a way that you often don't with adults because they have that sort of peripheral social knowledge of, they have an idea of what D&D looks like. They've right. watched a community episode or, you know.
And what did they have any concept of, like, of D&D? Like, did they have, like, a cultural sort of knowledge of what it might be?
They were such blank slates. I stood at the front of the class and I was like dropping keywords. Do you guys know what an RPG is? Have you guys ever heard of D&D or Dungeons and Dragons? Do you know anybody who, you know, about leveling up, you know, all of these things? Like, most of them were so young, they weren't even playing, like, video game RPGs, right? Because things like Skyrim and Mass Effect, like, those are now targeted at adults. So a 12-year-old might enjoy them, but a 9-year-old wouldn't necessarily be into them at all. So a lot of that, like, oh, I'm leveling up, I have these skills, that's sort of a new thing to them as a whole. And the only pop culture reference that they were able to find for me, there was, I think the oldest girl in the class was like, is it kind of like Dungeons and More Dungeons from Gravity Falls?
And you're like, I assume so.
Yes, probably yes. That sounds definitely like it's inspired by Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, if I had to hazard a guess.
Yeah, I was like, I think that's a safe assumption.
Wow, that's so funny. But that's cool because you also get to really kind of build the table culture from scratch. I loved reading about, like you said, the sort of dice rules that you guys came up with. Like, you can't just throw your dice anywhere. You have to roll them in this one specific place. And all these things that people don't really think about that are kind of just end up being assumptions or whatever at the table.
Yeah. It's neat because I play a fair amount of indie games just from the people I talk to. And I buy and read a lot more indie games than I get a chance to play. But the, you know, controlling who has what die or moving dice around or sharing dice changes the table culture. And there's definitely indie games where, like, you interact with the dice in really specific and structured ways. And it happens because it's there to enforce specific ideas of collaboration or turn taking or prioritization of certain things. And I got to play at Gen Con this year, I got to play Swords Without Master, and you share these dice. And so it's really important. And you choose who you give them to. It's not, no one requests them. You place them with somebody. And the dice culture of that game is such a huge part of that game. So I hadn't really thought about how it would affect the gameplay necessarily, being like, all of your dice have to get rolled in this felt-lined bowl, which was, again, literally a plastic bowl. We put some craft felt in, but It took the noise way down and they didn't go on the floor. But in the end, when you think about it, it becomes very much like we're going into this common spot and I'm going to figure out this. And it has a symbolism to it that sitting at your own, rolling your own dice has a different symbolism to it.
Yeah. It's kind of a focus of attention too, right? Like they go in the center where everyone looks at them, everyone reads them.
Yes.
How well did kids take to collaboration? Like, were they veering off into PvP, or were they like trying to do their own things, or did it come pretty naturally?
I didn't hear any stories of direct PvP, mm-hmm. which was really great. We had such a great group of kids. We were really lucky. They were really, really wonderful. They were excited to be there. They were excited to be at the museum, and they were really excited to play games. So they were already in the right headspace.
Yeah.
But the other thing we did, you let the kids come in on the first day of camp. They sit with their friends. It's clear who knows who, who's friends with who. And then we split them into groups in ways that didn't put them in groups with their closest friends, so that we didn't have those existing social structures and power dynamics at the table.
Mm-hmm.
They came to the table, it was a little bit blank, or they didn't know these people as well, or they weren't as close with these kids. So we sort of found that might have helped them focus a little bit more on the game and a little bit less on expanding their friendship by throwing knives at the cleric.
Right.
So we didn't end up hitting the PvP, which was great. We did have kids who just wanted to fight everything they met.
Yeah.
You know, they'd figured out that they were fighters and they were really good at that one thing, and they just applied it to every opportunity in the game. But we found that the groups actually started to take the stories very seriously. After sort of like the first two full sessions, they started to click in. There were a few stragglers who were, like, oh, I don't know, right? They were kind of like a little too cool for it.
Right.
But we still found ways, all of us, of getting them hooked, of giving them opportunities to be important in the game or do something significant. Or for my group, the ranger was sort of like, oh, I guess I don't know if I need to pay attention to all of these details. And then we told her that she had a pet. And it was a wolf, and she just hadn't read that part of her character sheet. She was like, I have a wolf. Oh my god, how is my wolf doing? And it was like the most important thing all of a sudden, which was great because it got her completely hooked. But in general, they understand collaborative storytelling, I think, at a gut level. Mm-hmm. And for some of them, they were utterly delighted with this new kind of structured way of doing it. I think that it sort of reopened it up to them. I feel like by the time you're 12 or 13, you're really losing access to some of that with your friends. I don't know the developmental stages, I don't know the milestones, but I know there's a stage where you've been playing pretend with your friends, you're telling each other stories, you're arguing with each other about what's happening, and then that slowly fades away, you lose access to it. But this is a new way to do that. And I think for some of these kids, they're like, oh my god, it feels like I'm really there. It all makes sense. It's not cheesy. I love it. And so I feel like they got really into it. And I'm not going to say that every kid is going to love tabletop gaming, because we had a group that had sort of been self-selected for, they would like to sit at a table and play games.
Right. I was going to ask about that as well, because I know that like kids at camp, some kids are really excited to be there, and some kids are like, oh, my parents made me. Like, what were the sort of varying levels of default buy-in that you had with these kids?
It was kind of neat. The camp ran in the middle of the summer. We were at the end of July. So some of those kids had been attending camps at the museum for 3 weeks by then.
Okay.
And some of them had even come to summer camps at the museum the previous summer in its first year of offering summer camps. So they were familiar with the museum. They were familiar with the process. Come in, sit in this room, eat your breakfast, go in, do this. And like the routine of the day and the sort of lay of the land, they had a pretty good feel for it. So they weren't reluctant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of them, certainly when I was sort of like, okay, let's talk about games we like playing, I got a long list of sports before we really got into the board games or the video games. But that didn't seem to result in skepticism about table games. They were all very excited to be there, and they were very excited, even without knowing what game we were going to be playing. The word game promised a lot. Yeah. And I think we really opened their eyes to what gaming could be like at the table.
Yeah. I also want to ask about the educational aspect of this, because in addition to keeping kids engaged and making sure they're having fun and making sure they aren't like leaving the table and wandering away, you're also ostensibly there to teach them about this piece of Persian history and this piece of culture and literature. How did you make your game educational without it being like an educational game, if you know what I mean?
I think tabletop role playing is incredibly suited to being educational. Mm. I think the act of playing it is the act of learning about the world and using that knowledge to succeed in the world of the game. And I feel like if anybody's listening and they've played a Viking game or they've played any, I mean, oh my God, if you've ever played Glorantha, you have to learn so much about the world. Or even if you're playing, you know, Call of Cthulhu, you learn a lot about the 30s, what kind of guns there are, what kind of cars there are, how you can get help, where you get information, you know, what the police are like. Just as the act of playing it, you get immersed in this world. So I really trusted the game to be able to do that without having to add anything too cheesy. But the one thing that I brought to it that I had sort of found in another sort of indie game called Sword and Backpack. Sword and Backpack is a party game. You sit and you play it with your friends. You know, there's like four stats and almost no rules. And the core element of it is this little pocket-sized journal every player gets. And your player character sheet fits, you cut it out and you can glue it into one of these journals. It's like the exact size. It's a quarter of a sheet of paper. And having those journals, writing your stats, what have you got in your bag, what did you do right now, where is your character, who are the bad guys, what's the new theory at the table, like that's super fun as an adult, and I thought that would be fun for the kids. So on the first day we made our own journals using grid paper and felt, and that was just the most successful thing I did.
Yeah,
we had kids sitting there, like 9-year-olds who filled their journals over a week with information about the game and the characters. And we used the journals when we went out into the museum proper, and we would go around. So on the first day, I was sort of talking to the kids about, you know, we're going to be looking, we're going to be traveling, we're going to be going over a big distance. So let's go into the museum and let's talk about travel and sharing of ideas and trade. And let's look at some of these artifacts. Where do you think this was from? What kind of climate is this clothing for? And, you know, start writing stuff down in your journal that you think you might use in game. And that was really effective. So we were able to go around and be like, okay, what are some animals you see here? Do you think you might meet them in the desert or the forest or the mountains? Write them down. And that that structure of going out and being like, okay, we're going to go learn and take notes, worked really well with Dungeon World, because so much of Dungeon World is the GM saying to the players, you've walked into a forest. What do you see? And the players get to answer some of that question. So for these kids, you know, say, oh, we've arrived. We're at the desert. Tell me what it looks like. Kids are like, well, I see snakes and I see big rocks and it's really hot and there's a sandstorm. And then they start listing stuff that they saw. You know, like there's, you know, I'm going to put on my hat. I'm going to put on my shoes. I'm going to make sure I have water. They're starting to take these things that they see that we've talked about in the museum proper, and they're bringing them in. So each kid had a journal that at minimum had a few lists in it, but I'm going to guess that every kid had character drawings, notes about what cool stuff they were getting. And there were a few kids. There was our youngest player was writing the story of his campaign. It didn't have a whole lot to do with what was actually happening at the table.
Cool.
It sort of went off on its own, his own thing, but he wrote this enormous story in, you know, 8-year-old pencil handwriting. Yeah. in this sort of like half size journal. And it was incredible. Like when I was 8, I was not writing like that.
Yeah.
Like it was not something you could have convinced me to do easily. And he was so pumped about it.
Oh, that's
and
so
he wanted
cool.
to show us. So that was definitely the most concrete way that I was able to, let's go get some knowledge, write it down, and then use it.
Right. And so I think some of what people find a bit intimidating about more collaborative games is that they're like, oh, someone's asking me what's going on in the world. Like, I don't know. What do I say? Is it okay if I say this? But you're literally just giving them like a huge pile of answers, like giving them all kinds of material to work with so that when you ask them, they're like, and kids love having their, having a good answer, right? And raising their hands and contributing. Yeah. Oh man. Yep. Ah, that sounds so cool.
It also, I mean, it helped them get into the feel like, oh, you're contributing to the world.
Yeah.
So by Wednesday of the week, like we had kids being like, I see a treasure chest. And you're like, you do. It's surrounded by snakes. Right? So you take their answers and roll with them. But it was so exciting to see them be like, I can affect this.
Yeah.
I can, if I want a new sword, I might be able to find it if I set it up properly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to understand how to negotiate with the existing story and with the GM to sort of get what they want out of the game without necessarily stepping on each other's toes.
Right. Yeah. And I'm wondering, like, how did they interact with each other? Like, I mean, were they sort of like leading each other? Were they kind of like goading each other into things? Were they really, was there teamwork?
All of the above.
Yeah.
I think each table had a slightly different dynamic,
mm-hmm.
As you would expect, I guess.
Yeah.
So I can speak most clearly about my table. I know that Jason, he had the youngest kid at his table, and the youngest kid was one of those players who was just going to fight everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other players spend a lot of time at that table being like, before you fight the giant, remember that we made friends with it, and it helped us leave the forest.
Right, right.
And maybe we don't fight the giant. We'd all really like it if we didn't fight the giant. The giant's our friend. So they were really good at sort of like calling him and getting him refocused on the story and getting him back in the game. At my table, I had half my players were incredibly invested in the story, and half my players were reluctant or distracted. Which is, I guess, what you would expect. And so it took a while, but the good behavior, the not the good behavior, but the like helpful, positive, contributing behavior of the kids who were super invested ended up serving as a model.
Mm.
And as the stakes got higher for them, the more reluctant players started to feel more responsibility for the two players who are, you know, no, we're going to do this. We're going to fight this battle. We're going to help this person. We're going to travel this distance. So they were collaborating more. And so there were certainly times when a player would be like, I make the dragon afraid of me and it runs away. And I'm like, well, roll for it. And they succeed. And the other player's like, no, we wanted to fight the dragon. So they weren't always agreeing on things. But they started to see moments when they could collaborate. And by the end of the week, so we enforced a rigid turn structure. Depending on the table, it might be throughout all of the gameplay. At my table, I was most strict about it when we were in combat, because the kids would just, you know, one kid would have all the ideas if you didn't make sure that everybody got a chance to do something. So with that rigid turn structure, you know, we always went in the same sequence, and then I was all the enemies. And so they would, you know, do their things, and then the enemies might also do something on top of reacting to what they do. But they started to realize if they wanted, you know, if the healer was last and the fighter was first and the fighter was injured, then they all had to skip their turns so the healer could heal the fighter before the fighter was really going to be able to do anything. So they started to see their different roles and take turns. And there was a wonderful sort of a combat where they had woken up a large den of small sort of goblin-y demons. Everything got reskinned as demons.
Yeah.
And there was like 25 of them, and they were getting swarmed. And the demons were like, oh, we're hungry, we're going to eat you, you're delicious. And our hunter, our ranger, was like, I'm going to go kill a deer and then distract them. And everybody was like, okie dokie, you go do that, we will fend them off.
Yeah.
And so they were good at starting to see, like, oh, who can help the most? What are some creative ways to tackle these problems?
Mm-hmm.
How can we distract them so they don't chase the hunter while she's off getting the deer? And then how can we direct them to the hunter when she's back with the deer? And how do we collaborate to have them, you know, trap them back in their underground lair with a big rock and the deer so they stop bothering us?
Right.
So they really did get into sort of their roles. One thing we did sort of outside of the gaming is we actually had a half hour. We sat all of the fighters at one table, all of the clerics at one table, all of the rangers at one table, and so forth, so that they could talk to each other about what they were using their character to do.
Interesting.
Not every kid is going to read the entire character sheet, even when you have a sort of a slimmed down one shot pre-gen character sheet. So
that's such an interesting technique. I wonder what techniques that you kind of developed for this really particular circumstance are you going to take with you and use in other games that you're running?
I think any one shot I run with people who aren't my regular group, I'm using the dice bowls because
yeah.
If you don't know what you're doing, the dice go everywhere, and some people are just real fidgety. So instead of having it become a problem and having to yell at someone, mm-hmm. we'll just have the dice be in the center, and they get rolled in this spot. And like, it's the idea of like a dice tower, right? Like, it's the same thing. So just, it's cheap and easy, and wherever I play, we'll probably have a bowl.
Yeah, pretty accessible. Or, you know, pretty accessible stuff.
Community space or a co-working space or the library, then we'll still be able to find something to use for that. So that was a big one. I think taking a minute, one of the things that I wish I had done at the beginning was taking a minute and talking about how the stats on the sheet translate to what kind of person your character is.
Right. Yeah, we assume them to be kind of shorthand and not everyone has that reference.
Yeah, so I think with obviously anything I do with kids, that's very important, and I really wish that we'd sort of gotten into that right off the bat. But if I'm doing a one-shot or something with adult players as well, I think it's always nice to sort of have a moment where they get to give you a little extra info about their character, or you talk a little bit, break down the character sheet so that they've had a second to get familiar with their particular character before you launch into play. Sometimes, you know, when you're playing, you discover new things, like, oh, my character is really good at charming people. I didn't know that.
Right, so. Right. And characters always like emerge through play. You mentioned in some of the blog posts that you guys did character portraits at the end of the camp rather than at the beginning. And I think that's so interesting. Like, that makes so much more sense than drawing your character in advance, because you don't really know who your character is until you start playing them, right?
Yeah, and I really wanted to let the kids grow attached to their characters mm-hmm. and have some inside jokes about their characters before we did the official drawings. But certainly there were character drawings in the journals as soon as they had character sheets.
Yeah.
And that's awesome too. I mean, I love that process I'm an artist. I love drawing my characters all the time. Mm-hmm. And they change as I play and they change as I draw them. That's fine. But yeah, I wanted the kids to sort of be like, okay, your character has done this. And now we are going to show you, like, you get to, like, immortalize them in construction paper and markers and glue. And we worked sort of in a paper doll approach so that the mm-hmm. kids, you know, kids who weren't as confident necessarily with drawing a human figure were still going to be able to have a character and they put cool stuff on them.
Right. And, like, what other kinds of crafting and other kinds of activities were you doing in the camp? And how much of that related to the games?
I tried to keep everything sort of thematically knitted together. If it wasn't about the game, it was about the Shanima. Mm. And the game was about the Shanima. So in the end, it all sort of tied in. And for, you know, with just a week to fill, it was pretty easy to do that. So we did the journals on the first day. On the second day, we set up the large collaborative. We had a cork board sort of in the hall outside the classrooms, and it was 10 feet long. So I divided it into the regions of our map. We had 6 regions on our map that they knew from the get-go. I sort of laid out, you're going to go through these regions. Rostam is going to go through these regions, and you are going to go through these regions. So I laid out in, you know, we had like a big yellow swath for the desert and a green swath for the forest and a gray swath for the mountains and so forth. And so there was like, here are the regions. Where are you in your game right now? And most of them are in the, you know, at the beginning, sort of first 2 or 3 zones. And everybody sit down and make something to go on the map that talks about something you saw or something you did. So we had kids sort of drawing the cafe where they got their quest mm-hmm. or the wall, the town guards at the wall that they fought and ran away from or the dragon that they met in the desert or the lion corpse they randomly came upon that had been killed by a horse that they ate.
Oh, cool.
So no other group got to see the lion. Because it was promptly consumed.
Nice.
Yeah. No.
Survival in the desert, man.
Very, Very practical. Practical yeah. choices. But lots of great stuff. And like some kids drew their whole camp, so multiple tents and a little fire and then some guard sticks around it and some trees. Like they started to populate these maps. So that was the second day's craft. And then, you know, kids are fast, kids are slow. So some kids did multiple, some kids were still working on one. On the third day, we made these dioramas. And we actually started them on the second day, if I'm keeping it straight in my mind. So we took paper plates, and I was like, you've now seen a lot of different areas and a lot of different things. Let's sit down with some craft supplies and make something three-dimensional that sort of encompasses a whole region. So if you're going to do the desert, you got to give it sand, and you want to make sure it has this. And I feel like that was a craft that was maybe a little complex for some of the younger kids. But we got some really cool stuff out of it as well. And it was stuff that at this point they were starting to also bring in things that they'd seen. They'd seen pictures of dragons and simurgs, which are a Persian mythical bird. They'd seen, you know, different clothing and different buildings in the illuminated manuscripts and in the exhibits at the museum. And so they started to show me all these different things, bringing them in. And that's one that I would fine-tune a little further if I ran it again and try and maybe focus it in a bit for the kids who need a little extra structure or guidance with it. But it was really fun, and we got some really neat stuff. On Thursday, we sat down with Felt again, and everybody made and decorated a little magic bag that they then made copies of all of their stuff for.
Oh, cool.
So if they had, like, specific weapons, or if they had, like, found a magic gem, or... you know, piles of money. They sat down. So I had a kid who was just cutting out little circles of yellow. Mm-hmm. I found a lot of gold. I have this much gold. Awesome. Put it in your bag.
Yeah.
And then on the last day, we added a few more things to the map, and we added our character drawings to the final map. So that was it, you know. And then we had time in the museum. We had time reading right. the stories, and they also had outdoors time because they're 9 to 12 year olds.
Yeah, you gotta let those kids out. Yeah,
they gotta run around. And then you gotta bring them back down when they come back in.
Yeah,
which is it's that sort of little the energy cycle of the day. But
yeah, god, I bet you $1 million they were out there LARPing the stuff that you were playing at the table.
Definitely some of them were. Some of them were playing soccer aggressively.
That's
either way, they came in relaxed. They did not come in relaxed. They came in super intense. And we had to all calm back down. We did story time after lunch often. So it was like, we everybody sit
That's
down.
That's a very good reset of the energy.
Shh, be quiet. I'm going to tell you a cool thing that Rostam did. But it was neat. The story, I think, was probably being able to have a story of an adventure, doing things like they were doing. Dealing with people that they would be dealing with. It gave them this sort of second layer where they were able to actually be very critical of some of the decisions Rostam was making and the way he was behaving. And then turn around and be like, oh, well, what am I doing in my game?
That's interesting. So they're really grappling with, like, they're really engaging with it as a piece of literature. And they're asking about motivations and they're asking about themes and what makes Rostam a hero.
Absolutely. And we, you know, we guide them through these conversations, but they're so ready to start talking about it and start analyzing it. And there's a moment where Rostam has a horse named Raksh, and Raksh is, you know, his sort of, it's his sidekick. And Raksh is around, helps him fight things, saves him from danger. And at some point, Raksh helps him defeat a dragon. And like immediately after, the next scene is Rostam singing a song about how great he was for killing a dragon all by himself. And the kids were like, wait, no, you didn't. They were right there. Like, he did not. He had help. His horse helped. He's so mean.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. By the end of the story, Rostam has sort of, you know, had someone else helping him and then makes sure that that person gets rewarded for their help by the king and really credits them. And the kids are like, hey, he learned. He's changed.
Wow, cool.
And I was like, so, you know, is Rostam a better hero now? And they're like, oh, yeah, definitely. So they really got into it, and it was really fun having those conversations with them.
Yeah.
Two thumbs up.
Yeah, wow.
Love talking to kids about that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you going to get to do something like this again, or would you?
I absolutely would. I am not sure what the museum has planned for next summer. It's really early mm-hmm. in the year for next summer planning, but it's certainly something I'm open to. It's a program that's been, you know, a similar program, not modeled exactly the same, has been running for about 30 years, as I understand it, at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto.
Right. Yeah, that Daniel Kwan is involved in, right?
Yeah. So Daniel Kwan can tell you all about that. It's an amazing program, but I think that it's already there as proof that this works as an ongoing structure, that you can have ongoing campaigns, and you end up with a generational effect of kids who've played it, who, you know, they start when they're young, they reach the oldest they can be when they're playing it, they come back to volunteer with the camp or start to GM. Then, you know, Daniel's story is that he played D&D at the ROM and now he works at the ROM. And I think that's something that any other institution that works with kids in the city should aspire to, having that kind of generational loyalty. And I think there's clear proof that these sorts of campaignings, you know, collaborative storytelling and learning experiences build that. So I'm really hopeful that there will be more opportunities to share this around, or to even find other places to try it as a pilot or as a one-off.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That sounds super awesome. So to kind of wrap things up, what are you up to when you're not running cool stuff at museums for kids?
I am a freelance illustrator and cartoonist. So I actually do a lot of illustration for tabletop games. And you can see some of my stuff in Call of Cthulhu 7th Edition, as well as a fair amount of Pelgrane books, including Guy and Reach. I have recently been working on Glorantha games. I have some characters coming out, some character designs coming out for the Coming Storm book, which should be out very soon.
I've actually not heard of Glorantha.
It's the world behind RuneQuest and HeroQuest.
Oh, interesting.
And I think those have been sort of detached a little bit from the setting. You can sort of play RuneQuest maybe without as much Glorantha, but Glorantha is a 40-year-old IP, I believe.
Wow.
30 or 40-year-old IP. They just put out an encyclopedia about the world.
Wow.
And it is the most detail-oriented IP I have ever worked on.
Wow.
It's been a fun challenge.
How do you get a gig like that? How did you get connected with illustrating for RPG specifically?
I owe all of this to Robin Laws. So I was in round two of art school learning about getting into concept art for video games. And I had put together a portfolio and I knew Robin. You know, he publishes with Pelgrane Press. He publishes with Atlas Games and, you know, has worked on a million things. And I was really like, Robin, would you take a look at my portfolio before I take it to this conference I'm going to? And he gave me some great feedback. And then a few months later was like, well, you know, I've actually got a gig. Would you be interested in doing a couple of illustrations for a fiction book I'm working on? I was like, yeah, I'd love to.
Cool.
And from there, it was, you know, I was able to sort of, I had a portfolio of some illustrations and take it to Gen Con with me. And you know, he's been sort of acting as a bit of a mentor, making sure that I meet people and, you know, very much vouching for me, which has been wonderful.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
Incredibly lucky. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm going to say it's Robin's fault.
This whole thing. Duly noted. Yeah. All the blame.
All the blame. And, you know, it's been super fun. And then when I'm not doing tabletop, I'm doing video game stuff.
Right, yeah. Which is also very cool and fun.
Yeah, different, but fun.
Yeah. How is it different? How is doing work for video games versus different than doing tabletop stuff?
Most of the video games I work on are not existing IPs. So you're coming in and building the world from thin air.
Cool.
Or specifically from research and lots of meetings.
Right.
I will say also, I've worked on a lot of very indie RPGs. You know, one person making their sweet darling baby game. And you are much more likely to see a finished product in that case than with a small team wrestling with an indie game. Video games are so big and complex, even when you're looking at a small one, that they take an enormous amount of time. But the nice thing about video games is that you tend to work very closely with the team. So right now I have two or three Skype meetings a day some days, making sure that what I'm drawing is usable, is interesting, is working for everybody else who's working on the game I'm on right now.
Right.
So it's a different feeling entirely than, you know, the RPGs thing. I get an email with a lot of reading and I sit down and I do my research and I get feedback, but it's, you know, through email and it can take a few days and it doesn't have the same sort of collaboration, real-time collaboration. It's more sort of asynchronous collaboration.
Yeah. Well, there's also a lot more people doing making games and indie games in the tabletop world on the side. As where I feel like you're probably more likely to work with a company when you're making a video game.
Yeah, it's a lot harder for a single person to make a video game, unfortunately. But yeah, for a video game to have the money to pay an artist, it's likely to be a video game that has a bit of a company structure and has received either, you know, some grants, or it's by experienced game makers who have, you know, a cycle going. They put out a game, they make a game. They put out a game, they make a game. So you tend to have that sort of existing thing, whereas in RPGs, you can just sit and make an RPG and play test it. And it's a little bit more bootstrappy that way. And the art costs on a video game versus the art costs in an RPG definitely mean that it's easier for someone with a day job to put out an RPG book with some nice art than to hire somebody to do concept art for an entire video game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just even the number of assets you need, you know, like a handful of illustrations for a book is very, very different than just the sheer amount of content that would go into probably a game. Again, a game that could afford to have an artist.
Yeah. Even, I mean, I've worked on little one-off puzzle games and hours. It's just a lot more pieces of art because everything on the screen is art.
Right.
As opposed to a book where everything in the book is layout and art is a part of the layout.
So, mm-hmm.
You know, put your money in a good layout person.
Good advice. I'm a huge fan of Bicrom, which came out in print pretty recently, right? There was a big Kickstarter.
It did.
Are you still making comics?
I am. So like you mentioned, Bicrom recently came out in print. I collected all of it. It's a webcomic where Conan gave me life advice.
So it's very inspiring.
I hear it. Tumblr actually created a little hashtag that said weirdly inspiring. And I was like, I will take that. I will take that and wear it as a badge. So it was 2 years of my life creating it. And then I sort of wrapped it up at the end of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And now I finally collected it all into this book. But I did it through a Kickstarter, which was amazing, and a lot more people jumped in than I expected. And as such, I have been shipping books for about 4 months straight now.
Right.
I'm really excited. I'm almost done. And when I'm done shipping comics, then I get to go back to drawing comics.
Right, right.
So I do have a few things coming up, and I'm really excited about them, but I can't put in time until...
Ooh, secrets.
Oh, you want some secrets?
Yeah. Give us the sneak peek in audio form of a comic. Yeah.
All right. I have two projects on the go. I'm working on a mini comic.
Mm-hmm.
I've been meaning for a really long time to make comics about some of my favorite music. I'm a really big metalhead. I love these really nerdy songs. And I love a lot of the dark themes in metal, but I don't tend to make horror work in general. And so I was like, this would be a really fun opportunity to try and do something a little bit darker and something that, you know, it's sort of a fan object. I obviously am doing it as a fan of the music, but it should be interesting or at least have some content for people who aren't. So I'm taking a song by one of my favorite bands, Opeth, taking a song from an earlier album of theirs, from the album Still Life, taking the song The Moor, which is like an 11-minute long song. And I sat down and listened to it on repeat for hours and sort of thumbnailed out a comic. And from there, I'm in the layout stage now where I've got my roughs and I'm going and trying to hammer out exactly what's on each page, what each beat is, what's happening. And so I'm hoping to have that out. I really wanted to have it out for Halloween, but I have to accept that we're halfway through October almost. So let's say before Christmas,
cool.
I should have that out. And that's going to be a wordless horror comic about grief, I guess.
Nice.
Yeah. There's the main character is on fire. So I'm not really sure how to pitch it yet because it's not totally there yet, but
this is all very good. It's all very mysterious and enticing.
I think it'll be mysterious even when it's done. So that's been a lot of fun. I've been watching a lot of how to storyboard for tension and creepiness.
And cool.
That's been really fun. And then when that's done, so probably starting in the new year, I'm going to be launching a probably about a year-long webcomic that is a sword and sorcery story set in a fantasy world that's really inspired by the Ontario Wilderness, which you are also familiar with in Ottawa.
Cool.
I got really deep into reading about how the Great Lakes were formed after the last ice age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really mind-blowing how much the land changed in, like, in a short period of time. There's living people were here when those lakes were created. Like,
wow.
Like cultures that are still in North America, mm-hmm, descended from people who were on the shores of rivers that changed direction because of glacial activity and started to form these huge lakes that we're living on now. In Toronto, we're literally on top of settlements of people who were here 9,000 years ago. So I'm really interested in that kind of history. I am not, on the other hand, someone who can tell that history. So I'm not going to try and speak for those people. There's a lot of people in Toronto who are doing amazing research and doing those sorts of things. And you can look into there's actually a wonderful map that'll show you on Google Maps where different, first Indigenous people's settlements were 9,000, 10,000 years ago around this area. So I don't need to tell that history. I'm not the person to tell that history. It's out there. But I'm really inspired by it and the idea of living in a world that's changing like that. So I'm taking that setting and making a fantasy world where, you know, the ice is melted, things are starting to grow, rivers are reforming, everything is soaking wet all the time because the water is just changing direction as the land shifts. And so what's happening is people are starting to come up and settle back into this place, but also very old magics are sort of awakening. And so I'm pitching a year-long fantasy comic that's a mystery. Something's going strange in this community and people have to figure out exactly what's happening, and it focuses on two farmers who are just trying to get started and settled and settle into their routine, and for both of them things start to sort of haunt them and come up and scare them and remind them of things that they're scared of, and they have to deal with it. And it's called Wolf Neighbors. Yeah,
that sounds very exciting. It actually sounds like a really cool setting for a tabletop game. to be honest, I think you should also release a campaign setting for
then I would really have to hammer out the magic.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if my listeners want to keep up with what you're up to and what you're doing, where should they find you?
I am Portable City all over the internet. So all one word, Portable City on Twitter, portablecity.net for my illustration portfolio, Portable City on Tumblr, Portable City on Instagram. And then if you would like to read these fantasy comics, or if you'd like to read the Vikram that I have online, you want to check me out at wieldcomics.com, which is a very old way of spelling wield, W-E-A-L-D comics.com. And mm-hmm, that's a very old word for forest. And I share that website with a good friend who also does spooky fantasy comics.
Cool. And people should totally go and check out your Patreon and see what's up there.
Yes, please definitely drop by my Patreon, Portable City on Patreon. And you can read all of my blog posts about this fantastic gaming experience I had.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also read all my blog posts about geological shifts in the Ontario local wilderness and what a kettle lake is and all of the other nerdy things I've been sharing there. And if you're interested in what I create, you can support me as well. And I would really appreciate it. I am so grateful for the support I have there.
Yay. Okay, well, that's a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on. This was super fun.
This was wonderful. I really, really appreciate you reaching out. Really, really excited to share this stuff with people who are also big nerds.
Yay.
Well, thanks again to Rachel. And as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's show, you can always send me an email, backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. That's @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. Over the past couple episodes, I've been talking about some of the other shows we offer, and today I'd like to recommend First Watch. First Watch is a bi-monthly bro chat with network founders James D'Amato and Kat Cool, filling you in on what they're up to and playing and excited about. If you're a fan of the network, it's really a must listen. James and Kat have a very charming rapport, and I think you'll enjoy spending an hour with them every now and again. You can find First Watch and many more great shows at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes!